Around the world, people are working to bring a greater sense of balance to the planet. Earth Wisdom Circles is here to showcase these people and projects. Now, here's your host for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio, Elaine Groman.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Elaine Groman on Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. And today I have the great privilege, and it'll be fun, to talk to my friend, Christopher Berryman, also known as Chris Berryman, who began writing at a very early age. And that writing has blossomed into becoming an actor, a director, and now a first-time author. And when he sent me his book a couple of weeks ago, totally impromptu, I was just delighted to see his name on the cover of the book. And I immediately called him and said, hey, let's do a little show about this. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you, Elaine. Thanks so much for having me.
It's wonderful. So before we get into the book, talk to me about, and let our listeners know about, you know, this process of being a creative individual, being a writer, being then a director and an actor, how all of this has opened you in ways that has brought you to this point.
Well, it's interesting. So I've been involved, like, the writing I was doing in elementary school with writing poems and stories, and I continued that through my teenage years through a journal and everything. In high school, I really got the theater bug, and I went to college. I went to New York for several years, Los Angeles, and then I came back to Michigan in 2009. But I think that it's interesting. I went to my first energy healing session because I was having trouble with my voice as an actor. So I think it was actually the walls that I was hitting with trying to get to a certain creative place, trying to really expand myself to be more available for the work that I was trying to do, which opened me up to this whole other realm of energy, spirit, whatever you want to call it.
Now, was that with you and I?
Well, that was actually before. That was in New York, and that was with a whole other practice.
Okay.
But I think when I came to see you, I think I was at another plateau that I was trying to get to another place in. And of course, that experience was profound. The work with this sacred geometry and other other awarenesses too. But so this the whole thing with for me. With creativity, with energy work, with I'm going to say the word channeling. It's all kind of interwoven now to me, and in my life, I think one sort of depends on the other. I think for me, and I think there's a lot of examples of artists and writers and painters out there who. Their process involves getting the intellect out of the way and letting, instead of trying to create something with my mind or ego, I think it's healthiest for me right now to approach it that way, to try to let the work come through as opposed to, being out there and competing, making things happen. That's just the best way for me to approach things at this point.
So I think that's really important for people to know. And can you tell us, please, what did energy work do, or what was the experience you had that shifted that from it being a very intellectual process to having it be something that's available, if you understand what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really eloquent way to put it. For me, the word that feels right is an opening of something. Being able to relax and be open to sources that maybe at one time I wasn't really sure were there for me. And what I've realized over the years, I mean, and I'm in my late 40s now, is that there's a universe of support. There's a huge amount of support for any creative project, for any situation, for any challenge that you might find yourself confronted with. And just allowing myself to trust in that source And that new way of working is something I'm still learning and something I'm still trying to practice every day.
Well, I think that for me, having done this a long time, several decades longer than you, my friend, is that, you know, we think of creativity as a problem. It has to be solved. But in reality, it is life working. And what we have been so compartmentalized in thinking that we have to solve something, or we have to discover something or find something, as if it is already missing. But the reality is, we are the ones who are missing in this equation or this beautiful experience that is life, that is already workable. So it's already here, it's already evident. But until we desire and have the internal fire to want to explore, then it's that door is kind of closed, but it doesn't mean it's not available. So, you know, it's like when you know, I know that you spent time in New York, and I can only imagine if you had to go to every single door in New York and knock on the door and say, is this where my creativity is? Is this where my creativity is? But it's there in the presence of the space. It's not behind any closed and locked door. It's within you, because you discover it the moment the door opens.
Oh my gosh, yes. And that's a, you know, that image of going door to door, I think I experienced that looking outside of myself for my creativity. And I think a lot of actors, people in theater, dancers, performers go through this. They're trying to, you're chasing something. You're trying to fit in with the system that's been around for a while. And where the source is really, it's really right here. And it's really within us, and waiting to come out in a unique way. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned that the hard way, through knocking on the doors, through trying to be something that was a little different than who I really am.
Well, I think that we all learn our best lessons when we're confronted with perspectives that aren't serving us. Yeah. And I think that I like what you just said about the fact that, you know, and I've never been an actor, but I would imagine that, you know, as you said, if there's a quote unquote method, and often what we're expected to do, I think, is to mimic what someone else is doing rather than to have the genuine experience of life be interpreted through you. So, and I think that that's what we're kind of looking, we're investigating and being given the opportunity to see now, that nothing is really hidden except in our own mind and in our perspectives that we have been entrained to believe are true, whether that's culture, whether that's religion, whether that's ethnicity, whether that's gender-related male, female roles, all of those things that by definition are a narrowing our focus.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, I love the fact that you began writing as a kid, as did I, you know, because it, and you just, when you have that experience of trying to express something, and I remember for me personally, when the first time I wrote poetry was when I was trying to understand death and the total absence of someone's presence. And where did they go? Why is this ache so great in me? But yet they're not here. And to try to find, where is that space? How do you discover that space? So that was my personal experience.
Wow. And have you noticed a difference? Because I know for, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but for a good part of your life, you've been a visual artist. Have you noticed a change in your work since being involved with more healing or energetic practices at all?
Yes, you're right. Since I was a little girl, and I'm 65 now, when I was a little girl, I was always encouraged by our mom to draw and to paint. And it was never make it look like this. It was make something from these things. There was no expectation of it, of how it would look. It was more permission to play, which to me, you know, it, when she passed, that was such a gift for me. And then I discovered, you know, at that time, I think when, you know, when we discover the intensity of our humanity, then we can look beyond our own story, our own prescribed view of ourselves. And if we give ourselves the opportunity, we see what is already workable and replicable. So for me as a kid, trying to understand the depths of grief, I would go out into nature and just watch this unfolding that had nothing to do with my opinion of it, had nothing to do, you know, if a baby egg fell out of a nest, did a mother endlessly grieve? I remember asking that of myself and seeing maybe for a moment, but then she came back and tended to the other young. You see, so I started to see that as, and a lot of the drawings and paintings I would do were of natural things, flowers and landscapes that were always changing. So there was nothing stagnant about life. And I think that helped for me personally, as being not really trained until I was an adult, a young adult in art itself, but being given the opportunity to explore, then I learned how to observe rather than take something at face value. Does that make sense to you?
Oh yeah, that's a very inspirational story, and I relate to that in many ways. Really, really interesting.
So, when you started writing as a kid, what was the impetus for that, do you think?
That's interesting. Again, it was a lot of poetry, and I think I was there was something that would just drive me to write. And I think I was into poetry and verse and mystery stories. And we had this, I organized these other kids in like third grade to write this ongoing soap opera. And it was just, it just all came very naturally for some reason. It was kind of mysterious, but it was something that was just there, that impulse was there. And, you know, maybe there was, because I was a kid, I mean, you know, you want to please your teachers, you want to stand out at the same time. That might have naturally been there too, but the to write down stories, to record some sort of something that I had seen or experienced, that was something that I really enjoyed as a kid.
Well, I think that one, I love that because poetry is unique, yeah, in that it is by definition a whittling down of words, so that you're attempting to convey deep meaning in a small number of words. And so I've learned this more in now that I'm working on my third book and having interviewed and written many different things, to understand that, first of all, as human beings, we know very little of our language. We know very little of the origins of our language and how language has manipulated us and how we manipulate ourselves and others through language. Often not intentionally, but we're ignorant to why words were crafted the way they were. And so I always saw, it's interesting because as an artist, I eventually became a calligrapher. And I wanted, I'm proud to say that my work was seen internationally. It was in a hardcover coffee table book. I was selected as one of the 200 best lettering artists in the country. But I wanted the words, because words meant so much to me and beauty meant so much to me. I wanted to understand the draw of making something so beautiful that someone would want to stop and be impacted by the words instead of just entertained by the words. So I learned how to, I would call it, pull an arrow back and let the arrow fly right to the intended target, which was to the mind or to the heart of whomever it was that was reading, whether it was that day that it was written or if it's 100 years from now. I want the target to be touched, not missed. So I think that the creative aspect of our lives has been greatly maligned because it's been greatly misunderstood. And to me, if we look around the world, and I know that you've taken classes with me and I've spoken about this, there's nothing in the world that is created by humanity that has not come from someone's imagination. But we need to have the left part of our brain, that part that knows how to put A, B, and C together. But without the concept, without the imagining, without the illumination, there is nothing to try to formulate. And so I think that creative individuals, in a way, will be, and I use this term very cautiously, the saviors of our world. Because they will to save us from ourselves, not some holy being coming to save us, but for us to choose to save ourselves. And I think that the gift of art and the gift of writing and the gift of collaboration and the gift of being willing, as you as an actor must do, is to elicit a response.
Yes, yes. Well, that what you just said triggered many feelings and thoughts in me. And one of the main one being that it's difficult, especially in this country, to pursue creative projects for the sake of doing the work itself, for some awareness, some story, some idea, some event. It's seen as a sidelined thing. To me, mm-hmm. It seems that way. It's not, it may or may not make money. I think the works that make a lot of money are respected tremendously, much more in this country. It might be different in Europe or Asia or different places, but I'm hoping that our relationship to creativity and to projects with, and this reminds me of the work that we do with my theater collective, which is sort of a pop-up. It happens as it happens. There's not a, we don't really do seasons or anything. We develop a work when it's ready to be presented.
Tell us about the name of your company, where it's located, because remember there's international listeners.
Oh yes, it's called Detroit Theater Collective, and we are in the city of Detroit, but we don't have a brick and mortar space right now, but we find them, we rent them, we find space to do workshops and eventually productions. And it's all the stuff that we present is, it has to be something that we really have a strong desire or a connection to. Otherwise, at this stage of the game, it's probably not going to happen.
So give me an example of something, a recent piece that you've created or a pop-up. Explain what you mean by pop-up. So for those people that are not familiar with that term, please.
Sure. I think that term, you know, there are dinners that call themselves pop-ups. And it basically, it happens at a space. It could happen anywhere. It could happen in a restaurant or a dining hall or a gym, or it just pops up someplace where somebody has allowed it to happen. And so that that is the way that we work as a company. We find a space that will let us do it. We might not ever work at that space again, but we do the work there. And one example is a play that we did presented last year. Unfortunately, the last weekend, which was almost sold out, was shut down due to COVID. You know, just like many projects across the world were shut down due to COVID. And this was a play called Anything that was made into a film, and it only, to my knowledge, had only one other theatrical production. But story of a transgender sex worker and a very depressed man from the Deep South who moves to Los Angeles with the intention of taking his life. And somehow these two people, these two souls find each other, fall in love. And it just felt very important for us. We had an opportunity to present that, to tell that story. And it just, we had to scrape together the money to make it happen. And I'm glad we did.
That's wonderful, because I think that, you know, we have so many prescribed notions of who we think people are, what we think people should be. We judge based on visual, auditory language that is so limiting. And I love the idea that you do something spontaneously. It almost reminds me of those, you know, things that occasionally you'll see on YouTube of a, it looks like it's spontaneous, but it's got to be incredibly choreographed of, you know, a flash, what do they call it?
Flash mob,
where it's somebody starts singing or playing a musical instrument. And before you know, it's like this incredible joy is unfolding and everybody's looking at it and observing it. So, yeah, that's very interesting. So what brought you to writing your letter or writing your book, Flying Saucer Visions?
Well, it was, it's interesting. It basically what I just described, that COVID happening, that place shutting down, being sheltering in my house in Detroit, pretty much by myself. I was Zooming with friends here and there, checking in on my mom here and there. But some interesting experience. I started having these interesting experiences. Some of them were visual, and some of them were auditory. Pictures, messages. When I was going to sleep at night is when I saw it the most clearly, I think. And I was just driven to write it down, to draw it, to record it in some way. And sort of like you said earlier about having it being presented with a set of materials, I knew I couldn't produce anything with the theater collective. I had these materials sitting in front of me, and I just thought, well, what can I do with this? And somehow the idea of an illustrated kid's book tapped me on the shoulder. That was the form that it was meant to take. And after about 7 months of laboring, putting it together, I was able to find an indie publishing company, self-published book, to put it into the world. And that's how it happened.
Was there anything that preceded this, the receiving of these images? Did any event happen in your life, or was this something that had been an ongoing process, do you think?
Well, interestingly, looking back, I think I started having them, noticing them. And this reminds me of something I think I've heard you say before about don't ignore the impressions that you're receiving. Don't ignore the things you're experiencing. I think I started having them during one of your classes. I think I pushed it aside because I didn't know what the heck it was.
And do you remember what your experience was?
It was an image of some sort of machine that I had never seen before. some sort of mechanical structure that I had never seen before. I was just like, what's that? And I sort of filed it in the back of my mind and didn't really think about it. But I think about January of 2020, I started having these experiences. It came into the forefront. The pictures became stronger. It was difficult trying to go to sleep with this frog staring at my eyes. And so I just started to inquire into it. And then that led to drawing and writing and having I had all these pieces of notebook paper with markers and messages and stacked up on my desk. And I just like, well, maybe we can make a story. Maybe we can create a story surrounding all of this.
Hmm.
And I don't know about what the origin is of it, but I just know that it came into being. So why not?
So tell us about the story, Flying Saucer Visions.
Yeah.
Travelogue.
The travelogue. Yes, that's the part of the full title, and that's kind of important. It is the story of two worlds coming together through the eyes of a gifted boy who is also a loner. And he starts having his experiences and ends up communicating with a band of rebel extraterrestrials from Orion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a bit of a theme of welcoming the stranger, I guess you could say, because he's able, he's cautious at first, but because he's able to ask questions and engage with these beings, he's rewarded with friendship and information and experiences that he never would have dreamed of before.
And you also have a little cat.
Yes, his best friend is a cat called Shockwave.
Mm-hmm. So how did you choose the name? Or the name of the cat? Yeah, here's the book.
Yeah, there you go. The cat's name, it was something, it went through a few options that presented themselves, and finally Shockwave felt right to me. I knew it was something to do with energy or electricity or something. It was first of all it was sonic, and I was just, no, it's not sonic. Shockwave. I think I googled many terms, and shockwave really jumped out at me.
So there's a great deal of symbolism in that, I think.
Yeah.
In that, you know, cats by definition are very stealth. You know, they will let themselves be seen, or they will hide.
Yeah.
When they react, they react swiftly. And
sure,
as we know, animals have an ability that humans either have forgotten about or never fully developed, or were never a part of our sensory perceptions, because we have the advantage of language and we have the advantage of choice. So they see, and their sensory perceptions are so heightened.
That is true. And that's, I hadn't thought that through so much, but that is, I love that there are those connections.
Mm-hmm.
It
reminds me of, you know, how animals are used to soothe people that are maybe in a hospital or that are traumatized in some way, that their energy can mediate the distance between the shock wave, the shock of an event or a trauma or an experience, and soften it so that it can be mitigated and maybe understood. And so whether you realize it or not, you open a lot of doors of how do we begin to look at things in different ways. I remember one time, this was very poignantly shown, When a client of mine, as you know, and many, maybe the readers or listeners don't know that I'm as an energy healer and an intuitive and an educator. I got started in this in hospice work. So I would often work with people who were given terminal diagnoses or had had some, you know, surgical procedure or something like that. And there was, the reason I'm telling you this is because the story has to do with a cat.
Yeah.
And there was a young woman who had, who has died, but she had bilateral mastectomy because she had very aggressive cancer that metastasized. And every day that she would come home from her chemo treatments, her cat would lay across her abdomen. And she had developed a metastasis to her liver. So in other words, the cancer had spread to her liver. And for a very short time, she began to have like a rally. She started to get better and had a little more time. But her cat died of liver failure. So the cat absorbed the energy of this disease process in order to give her a little more time.
Wow.
And it was so striking.
That's amazing. Well, in the story as well, Shockwave sleeps right next to the main character, Christian. Sleeps right down by his knees. And I think Christian can always feel, when he's going to sleep, feel the cat breathing as well. So I think that might, any loneliness that he has or any sense of, in my mind at least, sense of not fitting in me, I think the cat comforts him and maybe absorbs some of those feelings at the same time.
Yeah.
They're companions. They're like always together.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. Why did you choose the name Christian for the main character? Was there a reason?
Because it's partially me. And I'm Christopher. I'm not Christian, but I had to have some of me in there. Mm-hmm. And then his identity is, he has a, and if the, as the story continues, which I hope it can in some form, book form or other form, as he has one Polish-American parent, his mother, and one Chinese parent, his father. And hopefully this family, this dynamic will come out in the second book, in the second part of the story.
Well, that's interesting because two very diverse cultural systems.
Yes.
Asian being more ancient.
Yes.
But European being more, well, maybe not more, but certainly aggressive in natures.
Yes.
And as is all people. So right. It's interesting because that there's a cultural divide.
Yes.
That only humanity creates, because life was created for diversity.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, as a kid, especially if one of your parents is not present, Christian only lives with his mother, I think that that can perhaps create some feelings of not belonging or not fitting in at the same time too. So that's mm-hmm. That's something that's also sort of in the background. With the main character.
Mm. So tell me, as an actor, what do you find to be the most challenging thing to portray about a human experience?
I think it's challenging. I think it can be fun and it can be fun and rewarding, the deep dive that you have to take to get there. But it's if the character that you're playing has some sort of hidden or hidden motivation or need that's not on the surface, and you sort of have to have that at the same time, even though the character might present a different face to the world. One example of that is like the play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? This couple that are, they invite this other couple to their home, and all sorts of trouble happens once they start pouring the drinks and everything. But there's this secret drive that's pushing them And I think having both of those things, this inner need, and then the face that the character presents to the world, having those both of those things present can be a challenge. But it can also be a lot of fun to explore.
And what do you see it helps you as an individual learn about you?
Oh, my gosh. I think that it helps me confront, in me, and, you know, there are many actors, many great actors greater than me and who work more consistently than me. But I think it can really help you confront everything about yourself. If you are given a role that something you're uncomfortable with doing something that this character does, that can be a great, you have to confront it. You have to take it on. You have to embrace it and find a way to portray it.
Has there been any particular roles that have really been a challenge for you to illustrate in your acting?
I think this last play that I did, Anything, was the most challenging thing that I've ever had to do. Not because of the relationship, the central relationship, which was between a depressed middle-aged dude and a transgendered woman. Not because of that, but because of the deep depression and having to deal with the presence of suicidal ideation that the character experiences day to day. That was, I had to, you know, having to draw up all that, any of these feelings of, I don't want to be here anymore. Or the world might be a better place if I was not here. Where does that live in me? Because most of us have had these feelings at some point in our lives. So having to have that and then having to play the love and the fun of it at the same time, it was a real challenge. And I'm so fortunate that I had the opportunity to take it on.
Again, not being an actress or an actor, I would think that it's really powerful to look at where do these emotions come from? What is in our societal way of treating one another, believing it's okay to treat one another in a particular way? Where does that originate? Because I don't think anyone inherently has those kind of deep personal resentment without having experienced it themselves in some way or another.
Right. And one thing I learned about, I think as human beings, we're all seeking resolve and to be at peace. I think one thing that I learned from studying this, that part of that character that doesn't want to be here anymore, and it was a bit frightening to me, actually, is that sometimes suicide, this idea of suicide, presents itself as peace and release, and once a person makes that choice, there can be a tremendous sense of release that washes over them. And that that's a really interesting phenomenon, I think.
Well, I think, just to continue on with that, I think that, you know, we have many religions that say that there's always a place better than here. And so instead of really looking at with honesty, how do we make this the best experience?
Right.
Because this is the life, is the experience of existence, of our existence in the physical world.
Right. And but that's what I think depression can make a ton. Like, maybe we don't see the big picture that you're describing when we're depressed. We see this, and how can I get out of this? How can I change or fix this? And I think that's the most horrible thing about being depressed, is that we lose the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing correctly.
Well, I think it's an interesting metaphor that you have this book that you've written that is looking not beyond this life, but beyond our perspective and our perception of what is in existence.
Yes.
That, you know, even the image of this little child looking, you know, and this image just going right up to the spaceship of this connection.
Yes.
And I think that that's really beautiful that, you know, when we learn how to weave it all together, we don't know where we come from. You know, we don't even know that we exist until we recognize we have fingers, you know, as an infant, for instance, or a little baby. We have no concept, nor does those who have given birth to us understand where do we actually come from. Yes, we know we come from our mother's tummy. You know, that's the story. But what is the energy? What is the chemistry? What is the power behind all of that? That is the great mystery with which we are a part of it all. So to me, this beautiful exploration of writing and creativity and energy is all of the discovery of the same thing. This great mystery of what is this life all about?
You know? Yes, yes, absolutely, yes. And it's a great opportunity to do it. Just get it. I was listening to a podcast about a writer who said, she said, I don't like ideas to be in my head. I want them out of my head. I have to put them in some form. Whether something comes of that or not, it doesn't matter. But like, I think I feel that way too. If something comes and taps me on the shoulder, if something's in my brain, my imagination, I want to get it out in some way. And who knows what'll happen with it, but.
Well, the beauty of language is that it is not just A, B, and C strung together. It's tone, it's meaning, it's intention. It's an invitation if we want it to be, or it could be very secluded or exclusive. Then that narrows its capacity to affect life. You know, we want to write things that help us to look at, oh, yeah, well, what is that? Or what about that? You know, and I think that that's, I can only see great things for you, Chris, because I remember, I don't even know how long ago it's been, probably 10 years maybe I've known you.
Yeah.
That, you know, I remember seeing this look on your face when you saw something or you felt something. You know, there's this thing that happens with people and they go, how did you know that? Well, it's like your energy shifts. There's this, like this expansion that is like, when we see something or recognize something or experience something for the first time, that as you said eloquently earlier, it just kind of expands you. You know, we're only limited by what we think is our limitation. We're not limited by anything in reality. You know, talking about writing and getting something out there, I wish I could remember exactly where I read this or heard it, but it was an author who said that she would stand in her mind in a stream. And as the water rushed by, or in the wind, either one, it would be an equal metaphor, that it carried every bit of information of everything that ever happened. And so you're standing in a sea of information. And sometimes she said sometimes she would just get the very last line and start to pull it back towards her, even though it had moved down the stream. So it was available.
Wow, I got to try that one.
And it's interesting when you know you don't know. Yeah. Then if you go with a very prescribed idea of how you think something is going to be, it'll usually be boring.
Boring.
And dull.
Boring, yeah.
Because then you're going to try and mimic what is supposedly tried and true, which in itself might be boring.
Yeah. Right. You know? I think that's in my youth. And I think what we were talking about earlier about knocking on doors and everything, I think that trying to fit a mold or a prescribed way of doing something or making something. Yeah, I love that stream image, and just being a clean slate, just erasing the programming, the assumptions that we all make. That mm-hmm. feels like a really healthy, creative place for me to work from, and probably for everyone to work from.
So as you've worked with other creative individuals, Chris, how have you seen this time of COVID, which, you know, could be seen as a disastrous time or as an incredibly beautiful time of incubation, of looking at and really studying the workable and the non-workable?
Right. I do think that there are a lot of, I think this time with being at home, I think for a lot of people, it's been a great time of reflection. Actually, like things are making themselves known to people that maybe they never would have realized before. So I don't know, but I predict that there could be some kind of radical renaissance coming with, mm-hmm. and I think it has something to do with the meeting of spirit and creativity, and probably science too.
Well, inherently, a renaissance is a building. It's a regeneration. It's a reexamining the possible.
Right, right. So I do think that is happening and has happened already. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting to see. Might not be in the general culture or the popular culture, but you know, we have this thing, the internet. We can find things. Fascinating things that are happening all over the world. So,
right,
it's inspiring.
So, Chris, what's the best way for people to again to get your book?
The best way to get the book is on Amazon, Flying Saucer Visions by Chris Berryman, and it is also on Barnes and Noble's website.
Okay,
as well. Those are probably the quickest way in the United States. It's on Chapters Canada as well, and other merchants online too, but I think Amazon or Barnes and Noble's website.
And tell us about the illustrator.
The illustrator's name is Sheng Mei Li. She goes by Shen Li, and she is a young Canadian woman. And she's I've communicated with her mostly just through email and also through the project manager at the publishing company. And she is, I think her work is amazing. I've seen her greater portfolio. And some of it seems to be influenced by anime art. And I think, and she's also good at photo manipulation. But I saw her work and I just said, oh man, that is who I want to illustrate this book. And thank God she was available, because I really think she just added something that I could have never even imagined.
And what was that process like to work with someone that you've created the words, but she creates the visuals to complement or to enhance the words?
Well, I think that relationship can be very different. There's a lot of different ways that an illustrator and a writer can work. In this instance, I actually did design the basic structure of every illustration,
okay,
including the clothing that the characters were wearing and the colors. But then she came in and worked her magic and showed me things that I never even would have thought. She added so many layers to at the same time. And so it was a exciting process, something I'd never done before. So that was a treat.
I want to ask you about the part where you have all the geometry, where the little boy is in bed and all of the triangles are. I was so touched when I saw all those triangles, I have to tell you.
I know you like triangles.
Most people are going to wonder why, but you know. But then you talk about magnetism and, you know, this beautiful page of all of the mystery of what's around us.
Yeah, the initial visions, yeah, about what's around, what is around us, and maybe out there, maybe right here. Okay, I wish I could show you, because I did some very rudimentary drawings of those things myself. it would be really interesting. Maybe I'll put it on my website, of my drawings and then which how she took them and made them more dimensional, made more three-dimensional, and the color and the texture that she added to them. But those are all, everything in the book is based on something that I saw. And yes, there was a creative process that happened that morphed it. The story, it's fiction. So the story got taken to, it got taken to a different place, but that was the foundation were the visions.
Well, and to me, I see a lot of the symbolism. You know,
and I noticed that after it was written, you know, I realized that later on myself too.
Tell me what you notice about the symbolism of the violet and the gold together.
That came about because I did see this first. I saw the purple and then the gold with it. And it kept in one of my rules for what made the book was I had to see it at least twice. And so that came about. And then I also was like, what is this? But then through research about people who have had contact experiences, that idea of these beings pulling energy right out of the air came into being too. So it kind of melded together.
I was fascinated and really wanted to talk to you about the symbolism that I saw immediately. And especially with the violet and the gold, because they are complements on the color.
They are, yeah.
You know, if you were to look at the energy of the body and the chakras of the body, the yellow gold is the solar plexus, which is known as the seat of the mind.
The seat of the mind. Yeah, I've heard the psychic center too.
And the crown is the connection to what we would call the divine. So the seat of the mind has nothing to do with our brain. It's the place where we receive input of information through our sensory perceptions and have quote unquote gut feelings there. So it's a signal from the surrounding area that we happen to receive because we're in a sea of information all the time. But when we receive it, do we pay attention to it? And I think that that's part of the dilemma, but also part of, and it's interesting on the facing page is the cat looking up at the cosmos.
And that's Orion, that the cat is looking at as well. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Orion is the place of great wisdom.
Wow.
So, you know.
Who knew?
Well, you had, in one of our correspondence, you were asking about the history of what is referred to as the star nations.
Yes.
So, you know, if you don't mind, we can talk about that for a few minutes.
Sure. Sure.
Because, you know, I think we have to understand the beautiful songs of, you know, the 60s and 70s, we are stardust, we are golden. And it's time to get back to the garden, you know, and modern scientific study has discovered that, you know, gold, for instance, is not inherent to the earth. It is from outer space. It is not naturally occurring. It has come on meteors or meteorites or things of that nature. Okay. And, you know, I can't remember the name of the particular word for, you know, the understanding that everything comes from the stars. And many indigenous people refer to themselves as the people of the stars. Yes. So the Cheyenne,
star ancestors as well.
Star ancestors means that, you know, what's to say an ET is not our ancestor.
Right.
But I often share with people that talk about divine beings in a religious context, you know, all extraterrestrial means is not from this terrain. That's all it means. Extraterrestrial, yeah. From another terrain. So, you know, we kind of pigeonhole things incorrectly by assuming that we are, you know, we own beings. We own religious beings, angels, archangels. We own ETs. No, they're here to help us understand who we are. Because in our ignorance, in our both innocent ignorance and our willful ignorance, which is choosing to ignore what we know, we can be dangerous.
Wow. Well, that is, I want to read a book. I think you should read, that should be your fourth book, the premise of what you just said. It's so interesting. But in going back to the character, the main character of the book's name, his first name is Christian. His middle name is Foster. Mm. And that is significant too. Because hopefully in the further books, this might be explored, but his origins are not here. There's a reason why these beings are talking to him, is because his origins are from another place as well.
Well, I think that these stories are unfolding. Yeah. And they are ancient stories. You know, they're not new mythologies. You know, a mythology is a truth creating a story. You know, I remember a very, very powerful experience I had with a dear friend who helped me to understand what we call fairy tales are actually were ways for the bards of Europe to secretly bring information from one kingdom to the next.
Wow. Fascinating.
So, but you know, you think of Disney stories or the like, which are all mythology. And it's usually the woman being suppressed, but then becoming the leader. And so, you know, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs or Cinderella or Rapunzel or all of these things, you know, how do we begin to understand ourselves? And that's the beauty of storytelling. That's the beauty of drama. That is the beauty of your writing your book. And I really want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you. It's something that happened, but thank you for recognizing that. And thank you for this opportunity for me to share about it too.
Well, it's my pleasure. So please check out Chris Berryman. And what's the name of the website again, please?
Berrymanbooks.com.
Berrymanbooks.com. Okay. Chris, it was a pleasure to have you on the show. And I look forward to seeing what you're going to continue to do.
Thank you, Elaine.
And I'd love to come to one of these pop-up performances.
Yes. We'll have more, I promise. Maybe that's in backyards. Great. We're going to do backyards.
Oh, I got a nice backyard for it.
Cool.
Okay. Remember Thank that. You, Chris. This is Elaine Grohman for Earth Wisdom Circles on Empower Radio. You too can go out and make a difference in the world. Pick up a pen, use your voice, make something beautiful. It's what you can contribute to life. Thank you.